Ready?
Ready to go, guys?
Welcome to the Senate Business Transportation and Economic Development Committee. We're going to take these a little out of order to allow Senator Johnson. I'm going to open on public hearing on Senate Bill 537 to allow Senator Johnson to make her testimony and then go back to work. And I'll recess and then we'll get back to the order. So, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your courtesy with respect to scheduling this bill. Members of the committee, if there was ever an unlikely soul to testify about restricting helicopter operations in a certain locale, it would have to be me. Having been a commercial helicopter pilot for 25 years, at one time a member of the United States helicopter team, you cannot find a bigger fan of helicopters than I am. But occasionally there are operators who appear to be sufficiently insensitive to the concerns of their neighbors that legislative action seems to be the only avenue to seek redress for issues of noise and issues, in this case, possibly of safety. And so we bring before you, at the request of Washington County, Senate Bill 537. I believe County Council from Washington County is here prepared to give additional information about the bill. I just give this as an opening preamble for why this piece of legislation is before your committee.
Thank you, Senator. Is there any questions of the Senator?
Yes.
Senator Atkinson.
Senator Johnson, what kind of helicopters are the bad actor flying here? Are these Chinooks or Robinsons?
They're largely aerial applications. They are large helicopters. They are in proximity to Hillsborough Helicopters that has Robinsons, so there are lots of noise issues out of a training facility associated with Hillsborough. But these particular helicopters are large industrial helicopters.
More? What kind of landed in your field?
I'm just kidding.
I knew you were
an airplane guy.
Thank you very much, Senator.
And
we'll let you get back to work.
Thank you very much.
We will recess on Senate Bill 537, and we will open a hearing.
Representative Keelan just walked in.
I know. Okay. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 442, Senator, or Representative Cameron.
Excuse me.
No problem, Senator.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, State Representative Kevin Cameron representing South and East Rural Salem, Almsville, and Turner. Thank you for allowing me to come before you and testify in Senate Bill 442. The bill that you have before you basically is a license plate bill that would allow Oregonians to voluntarily contribute in purchasing a wine license plate. That is a great thing about our state, that we've all probably had some good wines made here in Oregon, and we should be proud of that. This particular bill would help, the monies that would be raised from that would help promote the tourism of the wine industry and the entire state for that matter. It is a good thing for the state of Oregon, a good thing for our wine producers, and I'd urge you to support Senate Bill 442.
Senator Gerard.
I was just smiling. I think this is a good bill.
That's a good deal.
I was trying to think of a way to promote wine, but given the fact I don't drink, it's a little bit tough.
Anything else? Senator? Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you very much.
All righty. And I've got a long sign-up list here, so I think we'll start out with Amy Joyce from the department giving us an overview on the wine, on not the wine plate, but plates.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and with me today for technical expertise is Lana Cully, Program Services Manager for the Department, the Driver Motor Vehicles Services Division, or the DMV. I'm here today to give you a brief overview of the PLATE program that DMV runs. so that you can understand the context in which Senate Bill 442 comes to you today. So DMV issues a variety of vehicle license plates. They include general issuance, specialty plates, and group plates. Specialty and group plates are used as fundraising tools for nonprofit and other groups. A surcharge beyond the usual registration fee is levied on these types of plates, and that money is distributed to various funds. On average, there are about 2 million passenger vehicles registered each year in Oregon, but most of those are renewals. We've got about 315,000 license plates that are newly issued each year, and of those, typically about 10% elect to do a specialty or a group plate. We've attached a number of charts that show some sales figures over time that you can take a look at. But trends over time show that the numbers of specialty and group plates go down over time. So since 1987, Oregon's general issuance plate has been the tree plate that we're all familiar with, which the plate design was a winner of a legislatively sponsored contest. It's issued to passenger vehicles, light trailers, and other types of vehicles like motorcycles and RVs are issued a plate with yellow background and blue characters. So the next item beyond general issuance plates are the specialty plates. These are, again, to raise funds for specified organizations, and currently the state statute allows only three specialty plates at one time, and those currently are the Crater Lake, Salmon, and Cultural Trust plates. But recently the legislature also added a fourth specialty plate, Pacific Wonderland, that capped the number of plates issued under that program at 40,000. So when 40,000 is reached, that will drop off and we'll go back to three under the current law. The background of a specialty plate is designed by the requesting organization with review by DMV and law enforcement. And the registration fee for specialty plates is the same as the standard registration fee, but then that surcharge is added on top when the customer requests the specialty plate. Crater Lake, that plate requires the surcharge only at the initial issuance, and then you're done paying extra for that one. Salmon and Cultural Trust, you pay at the initial issuance, and again at each renewal you pay it again and again to keep that plate. One thing to know about specialty plates is that the Oregon Constitution limits the use of highway funds to construction and maintenance of highways. Therefore, the highway fund cannot be used to pay for specialty plates and the extra costs involved there. Therefore, the group has to pay some upfront costs to cover that so that no money is coming out of the highway fund. Upfront costs typically range at about $50,000. The written testimony, I want to correct something there, it says a range between $50,000 and $125,000. That high end is an older number and is quite a bit less as the high end. So around $50,000 really is the true number as the initial startup cost there. It includes significant computer programming, and then ongoing costs going forward with specialty plates come from that surcharge as that's collected. A little bit of it is diverted for administrative costs. And in 2003 is when the legislature limited specialty plates to just those three at a time. It was done as a streamlining effort to address the proliferation of plates, which had become somewhat cumbersome for the department to administer. And recall that the fundamental purpose of a plate is to identify the vehicle and ensure that registration fees have been collected. Group plates are the next type of plate. They are also to raise funds for specific groups. Currently, group plates can be issued to nonprofit groups, 501c3s, or for higher education institutions. And then there's another type of group for veterans organizations. At present, there are 32 different active group plates available for purchase from DMV. There are an additional eight types of plates that are no longer active because they didn't meet minimum yearly sales quotas, but they are still available until those stocks are sold off. to establish a new group plate, an organization applies to DMV. They have to pay an initial $10,000 application fee. That's statutory. And that is part of the upfront cost for a group plate of about $26,000 that, again, the group must pay for itself. Additional time and funds going forward, again, must be paid by the group, not from the highway fund. And group plates are maintained only at DMV headquarters, not in field offices. So if someone wants a group plate, they apply for it. That goes to headquarters for processing, and then the person is mailed their group plate, unlike specialty plates, which are held at each field office. A group needs to sell at least 1,000 of those plates in the first year, and then they get that $10,000 registration fee refunded. If they do not sell 1,000 in the first year, they don't get that registration fee back. And going forward, they need to sell 500 sets of plates per year, or again, they go inactive at that time. The 2007 legislature created the Veterans Recognition Group Plate Program, serving as sort of an umbrella for veterans organizations, so that all of the veterans groups come together to meet that 500 per year quota to stay active. Most of the veterans recognition group plates are only issued to individuals meeting certain criteria, such as having served in a particular branch of the armed forces. And for group plates, again, DMV collects a surcharge on behalf of the group. The revenue from the surcharge after cost is distributed to the groups, and the average revenue distribution for all group plates is about $5,000 to each group per year. DMV has a number of other plates statutorily created. They're listed in my written testimony, and I won't belabor that. And so funds raised. The amount of funds raised for a specialty under a specialty plate or a group plate, the fund raised is dependent on two obvious things, and that is the surcharge amount imposed, the amount and how frequently it's charged, whether just at issuance or both issuance and renewal, and the number of plates that customers actually buy. The specialty plates in existence today, Salmon, $30 surcharge at issuance and every renewal. Crater Lake, $20 surcharge only at issuance. Cultural Trust, $30 surcharge at issuance and every renewal. And that Pacific Wonderland sort of temporary specialty plate, $100 surcharge at issuance only. So in summary, the department issues a variety of license plates, primarily the standard tree plate. Specialty and group plates make up about 10% of passenger plates that are issued. They've got specific surcharges attributable to each of them that are transferred to the respective organization's designated fund. Costs cannot come from the highway fund, and so the organization must come up with that up front. And the law currently allows for only three specialty plates at a time, except that that temporary Pacific Wonderland plate is still being sold. And you can see sort of visually the first attachment there shows sort of all the different plates, some active, some inactive, specialty, group, and custom plates. So that's a quick overview of DMV's plate program.
Thank you, Amy. Questions? Senator Starr.
Thank you. How many license plates overall are sold every year, including the tree plates?
It's about 315,000 total new plates sold.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Might hang around in case we have some questions.
I sure will. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. All right. I have a number of people here. I have one person who's marked that they live more than 100 miles, so we'll start with that person. Austin McGuigan?
That's incorrect. I don't live more than 100 miles, so I must have marked the wrong box there. So.
All righty. Thank you, then. Then we'll start with Angie Morse. Wait a
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angie Morris, President and CEO of Cultivating Communities, 181 High Street Northeast, Salem, Oregon, 97301. I'm delighted to speak with you today about Senate Bill 442 to create a wine country plate. This is a tourism bill that will pump new dollars into communities throughout this great state. This is about economic growth and creating vibrant Oregon communities. Cultivating Communities is an education-based nonprofit dedicated to the travel and tourism industry and was created to provide support and resources that aren't currently available. While the nonprofit is relatively new, approaching its first anniversary, the experience and track record of its staff and board are extensive. The staff is made up of seasoned professionals with combined management experience of more than 30 years in the tourism industry. The board of directors includes established leaders from the business community, representing a wide variety of industries and perspectives from Marion Polk and Yamhill counties. In addition, we have secured the financial resources necessary to launch this initiative. Cultivating Communities has the broad-based expertise, professional competence, financial resources, and commitment necessary to establish the Wine Country Plate, galvanize the tourism industry, and efficiently get new dollars working in our communities. This is a budget-neutral bill, with Cultivating Communities, a private nonprofit, assuming all financial responsibility to execute the administration of this piece of legislation. This bill is designed to give lift to the travel and tourism industry and support businesses, nonprofits, entrepreneurs, and individuals throughout Oregon. This bill is not about one region or one category, but about the entire state and the collective tourism industry. The proposed revenue split of at least 50% of proceeds benefiting the Mid-Willamette Valley and at least 35% of proceeds supporting communities throughout the state is grounded in data that shows the large majority of wineries are in the Mid-Willamette Valley, but it also recognizes and invests in other wine regions around the state, as well as communities that don't have connection to wine country. In fact, no matter how you look at the numbers, whether it's the number of vineyards, grape production, or gallons of wine produced, the statistics clearly demonstrate that a heavy concentration of the wine industry is based in the Mid-Willamette Valley. I share this with you for no other reason than to explain the rationale for how we arrived at the revenue split. The 35-50 split is fair and balanced. Regardless, this initiative is about the greater good and spreading plate proceeds around the state for the benefit of Oregon's economy. The Wine Country Plate celebrates Oregon's amazing culinary heritage and provides a powerful marketing platform that will further brand Oregon as a premier international tourism destination. The branding muscle behind this initiative alone is of tremendous value to Oregon, its businesses, and its communities. Why is this bill focused on tourism? The tourism industry drives $8.4 billion in economic impact for the Oregon economy and is the largest traded sector employer in the state. It generates transient lodging taxes, lottery funds, gas taxes, and property taxes when visitors convert into residents. Tourism creates jobs and enhances Oregon's quality of life. The industry includes many different categories, including restaurants, lodging, retail, attractions, recreation, cultural heritage, etc. And the wine industry is an essential and inspiring component of the tourism industry. This bill would create a new funding to support the tourism industry, which will directly benefit the wine industry, as well as many others. Wineries will be able to get grants for their projects and ideas, just as other tourism businesses will have the same opportunity. Cultivating Communities will maximize plate proceeds by investing in creative projects, entrepreneurial ventures, and exciting partnerships, and doing critical work in the areas of workforce development, product development, scholarships, marketing and promotion, education outreach, and so much more. Plate proceeds will also leverage the work already being done by Travel Oregon, the Oregon Wine Board, and all of the destination marketing organizations around the state. The Mid-Willamette Valley's iconic tourism asset is wine country, much like other regions of the state which leverage their iconic tourism assets, such as urban experiences, Mount Hood, the Gorge, the Coast, Crater Lake, outdoor recreation, rugged cowboy country, and Hell's Canyon, to name only a few. However, this bill seeks to support all of Oregon's fabulous wine country, as well as the regions of the state that don't have wine product. If the tourism industry is successful, then the wine industry is successful. And if the wine industry is successful, then the tourism industry is successful. They are inextricably linked and work in synergy to bring value to our local economies. This is a voluntary initiative. Consumers choose to buy a plate, and by doing so, they will know that their dollars will work at the highest level to support the tourism industry and directly benefit wineries all across the state. What they may not realize is that they'll also be directly supporting job creation and real solutions that enhance the quality of life for all Oregonians. This is a win-win opportunity. Chair Beyer, I would welcome any questions or comments from the committee, and thank you again for your consideration.
Angie, let me just start with one. You're probably well aware that the constitutional limitation on the use of road funds requires that any plates like this pay for outside. So I noticed you have $10,000 in the bill to start, but the fiscal that we have here says that it's approximately going to cost $60,000 to start a cost. You got $60,000 committed to do it if this bill goes forward?
Yeah, we actually have $85,000 committed to play for plate production costs and original marketing costs to get folks aware of the plate.
Okay. Questions? Senator Girard.
Just have a quick comment. First of all, I have a lot of wine industry in the north end of my district, and I think this is a good bill. In the south end of my district, I also have a lot of covered bridges, which tourists, and what I'd like to see, you were talking about kind of a tourism approach, a little bit of outreach to the areas that are not going to benefit from this. So just going to throw that out there that, you know, Linn County, for example, I think we have the most covered bridges of anywhere in Oregon, and it's a nice place for tourists to go. But the wine industry is kind of a bright spot for the economy right now because it is expanding, especially in my district. A lot more grapes are going in, so I think it's a good bill.
Any other questions?
Just a quick comment.
Senator Atkinson?
This is very nicely done in your packet with all the support letters. It's very broad.
Thank you.
Okay. Nothing else? Thank you very much. Senator.
I can testify.
Senator Bonamici here.
She's here.
I am going to temporarily recess Senate Bill, 442, and open a hearing on Senate Bill 479. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you want to have my constituents come up with me, or do you want to wait on that?
That would be fine if you'd like.
Chair Beyer, committee members, thank you very much for holding a hearing on Senate Bill 479 today. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17. Senate Bill 479, you probably won't see too many bills in this committee dealing with anatomical gifts. Senate Bill 979 is about increasing organ donations to save lives. According to the website of Donate Life Northwest, in the United States, 18 people a day will die waiting for an organ transplant. More than 105,000 people in the United States are waiting. More than 2,500 of those are in the Pacific Northwest. So my constituents who are here today, Rex Brassel and Eleanor Golay, are here, and you'll hear from them about their story. When we met, we talked about the need to increase organ donations, and we talked about various approaches. And one of the things that we talked about, I'll mention briefly, was presumed consent, where people would opt out instead of opt into organ donations. That happens in several European countries, and it's been proposed in a few states where it has never passed. So it does raise a lot of medical ethics issues, and so we started looking for another approach that we could bring to increase organ donations, maybe some more realistic options. So I read a book. It's called Nudge, and it's written by the sort of libertarian-leaning economist Richard Thaler and the legal scholar, Professor Cass Sunstein, and it's called Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. And there's a chapter in the book about increasing organ donations. And there's a long discussion about the presumed consent approach. But what we really focused on was something that's called mandated choice. And I understand that sounds a bit like an oxymoron. But what happens under this proposal is to get or renew a driver's license, make it a requirement that the organ donation preference be indicated and that the application not be accepted unless one of the boxes is chosen. It doesn't require the person to choose that they'll be a donor. It just requires that a choice be made. Now, research in other states where they've tried this, in Illinois, for example, showed that 87% of adults believed that registering as an organ donation was the right thing to do, but only 60% were registered as organ donors. Now, I want to recognize our Department of Motor Vehicles. They've done some excellent work in this area, and they do have a policy where they require that the DMV employees ask everyone if they want to become an organ donor, but it does not require that they check yes or no. Based on the information that we read in this book and what's happened in other states that have required this, this should increase and is intended to increase organ donors. So Donate Life Northwest has a mission. It's to save and enhance lives through the promotion of organ, eye, and tissue donation. We can help further that mission with the Senate Bill 479. It's admittedly a small step, but it's a step that can and likely will save lives by increasing the number of organ donors. So I encourage you to send Senate Bill 479 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I would like to give my constituents an opportunity to briefly tell their story. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, Senator, before we move to constituents? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rex Brazel, for the record. I appreciate this opportunity for me to talk about a life and death issue. I wouldn't be here today if I were not a recipient of a kidney donation. I'm one of the lucky ones. My wife was able to give me a kidney. Hundreds of other Oregonians don't have a living donor to save their lives. They're on waiting lists for a kidney. The kidneys they're waiting for, if they come in time, will come mostly from accident victims who have signed an authorization on their driver's license application saying that upon their death they're willing to donate their organs. If anything could be done to increase the number of donors, many lives will be saved, and I think we would all feel better about ourselves if we played a part in accomplishing this. I urge you to support Senate Bill 479 because I believe that more people will donate their organs if they think about it more when they get a driver's license. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. My name is Eleanor Galle, and I'm his wife. And we live in Portland. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to offer my support for Senate Bill 479, introduced by Senator Bonamici. As she already told you, my husband Rex and I asked her to look into ways of improving Oregon's current organ donation program. And this bill is the result of considerable research on her part into the best way to achieve what we asked her to do, and we are very pleased. I look at this issue from several perspectives. First, I am the wife of someone who had end-stage renal disease and needed dialysis until he received a kidney. Second, I am a donor, since we were extremely fortunate and I was both a match and was healthy enough to donate one of my kidneys to my husband. And finally, I speak as someone who ran Medicaid, ran the state health planning division, and was involved in several healthcare cost containment and reform efforts in New Mexico in the early 1980s. This latter experience helps me to see my personal experiences in a somewhat broader context than might otherwise be the case. According to the Organ Procurement and Transportation Network of the U.S. U.S. Health and Human Services Department, as of February 25, 2011, there were 763 people on a wait list for an organ in Oregon, some of whom have been waiting for more than 5 years. I believe that Senator Bonamici's office will have provided you with a couple of charts that we copied out from the website.
No? I'm not sure we got those, but we'll get them.
You did. Well, they're available. I hope you'll be able to look at them. Clearly, this situation is creating great hardship, and we believe we can do better. Having worked in public policy for many years, I know that it is often helpful to have things put into law that are being handled administratively, as is the case with the organ donation option on the state driver's license form. This bill will, I believe, accomplish three important things: increase the number of people who agree to be organ donors, help families who are distressed make the difficult decision about whether or not to donate their loved one's organs, and it will ensure that the current administrative policies are continued into the future. As with so many other people, kidney disease and organ donation was a mere abstraction until about 2 years ago when we learned that Rex's kidneys were failing. 1 week ago, on March 1st, we celebrated the one-year anniversary of our surgeries. Rex woke up from the surgery and felt better than he had in months. We have our lives back. We recently returned from a three-month journey around the world. It was a celebrate life trip, one that we could not have taken without the transplant. On March 3rd, we had the one-year anniversary appointment with the transplant clinic. We've been looking forward to this. The physicians there kept telling us that they love these appointments because the patients whom they first met when they were terribly sick are now, like us, getting on with their lives. Rex's nephrologist told us that if it weren't for transplants, he simply could not do his job because there would otherwise be so little hope for the patients that he sees. Donated organs not only transform the lives of the individuals who receive them, but the lives of their families. I have gone from being Rex's caretaker to being, once again, his partner. We have become friends with other organ transplant recipients and are continually amazed at the way they and their families also embrace their new gift of life, going back to work, supporting their family, traveling, volunteering to help the community, that is, leading full, rich lives again. Although we were fortunate and I was able to provide a living donation, only about a third of all donors are living. The rest are from deceased donors, the result of someone who specified they want to be a donor and a family that understood this and honored their wishes. If this bill results in the addition of only one more set of organs that save the life of only one person, it would, in my opinion, be worth it. If it helps one additional family make the anguishing decision to donate their loved one's organs, knowing that they are following that person's wishes, it would be worth it. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, one deceased donor saves up to 8 lives. I believe this bill will save more lives than that. Bex and I are believers in the political process and have been active politically and with public policy most of our lives. For that reason, our response to our experience has been to see if there was some way that we could help increase the supply of organs so others could enjoy similar benefits. We were fortunate to meet and be able to discuss our concerns with Senator Bonamici, who has done a wonderful job, we believe, in crafting this bill. We are grateful for the opportunity to testify before you today and for your consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of the Senator or Senator Girard?
This is for Senator Bonamici. This is kind of a technical question, but are educational cadavers included in this or not?
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard. I don't believe that would be the case because it just applies to, it deals with when people are getting a driver's license.
Okay.
There is somebody here from Donate Life if there are additional questions.
I'm going to get them next. There are no other questions. Thank you very much.
Could I just ask a clarification? It looks to me like, and I apologize for being late, Mr. Chair. Maybe this was answered before, but if someone doesn't want to answer yes or no, what happens to their driver's license?
Then they aren't able to get their driver's license. It's just a requirement of getting the driver's license to say yes or no. If they aren't sure, they'll probably check no, but the research, sorry, Chair Beyer and Senator Burdick. Similar policies have been implemented in other states, it does increase the number of donations because studies have shown that there are more people who want to be organ donors but just don't take the affirmative step to do so.
Thank you.
Further questions?
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. And we have one other person signed up, and I'm going to go ahead and take Mary Jane Hunt now. We'll let you go back to work, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Jane Hunt. I'm the Executive Director of Donate Life Northwest. For 35 years, we have been educating the public and promoting organ, eye, and tissue donation. We are here today in favor of Senate Bill 479. And I wanted to just give you a little bit of a background. We have been very fortunate in this state to have an excellent relationship with DMV since 1975 when that D code was added to the driver's license. Today we have many Oregonians who have signed up through the DMV, but it is just not enough. Basically, what we wanted to talk about is recent statistics show last year, 38% of Oregonians who were not coded as a donor or hadn't registered are saying yes. Now, we also know that in the public, there's 9 out of 10 people who favor donation. So we know that there's a little bit of a misstep. While DMV has been very active in promoting and asking, we also know that there's been some inconsistency. We do receive some calls on occasion where individuals who have gone for their permit, their license, or ID card, that they were not asked. Senate Bill 479 strengthens our current practice and our law that gives people the opportunity to say, yes, they would like to be a donor. I'm here to answer any specific questions. I'm hoping you did receive copies of my written testimony. Thank you.
Any questions? Ms. Hunt? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 479? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 479, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 479. The chair would move Senate Bill 479 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing no discussion, is there any opposition? Seeing none, Senate Bill 479 is moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Carrier.
Senator Gerard will carry. Thank you very much.
Do you want to ask Senator Bonamici to carry it?
Oh, what? Bonamici?
Oh, I should have. Senator Bonamici, would you like to carry the bill?
Well, I'd be honored to, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Senator Bonamici will carry the bill. Thank you, Senator. Okay, we will reopen our hearing on Senate Bill 442. The next person up is, and I'm taking an order of sign up here. Oh, boy. Pierre Zurich. I get close?
Pretty close.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Meyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pierre Zurek, Managing Director of the Allison Inn and Spa in Newburgh. Since the very beginning, the Allison has been a project built from love, the love that the Austin family has for Oregon and their local community in Newburgh. So it was with much anticipation that our doors opened in the fall of 2009, and we are proud to make our home in the heart of the wine country, and to be known as the only luxury hotel within the Willamette Valley wine region. With over 200 wineries in our backyard, visitors are from all over, adorned by the region internationally acclaimed Pinot Noir and other fine varietal, and the Allison quickly became the living room of Oregon wine industry and world travelers. However, as we are only a short distance from downtown Portland, as well as the coast, we could not be any happier that 48% of our guests are from right here in Oregon. To date, we have several significant wine groups stayed at the Allison. This group coming from such areas as Dallas, Chicago, Houston, Phoenix, Newport, and San Francisco come to stay with us for not only what we could provide in luxury accommodation, but for our distinct location in primary to visit the area amazing wineries. Each of these groups stayed a minimum of 4 nights, with us allowing them to take a full advantage of touring and tasting their way around the area. The impact that this and other type of groups have on our economy is truly significant, as not only they are visiting the winery, they are buying their wine from here as well. Upon departing, one group left having purchased upward of 650 bottles to take back with them. Tasting rooms around the area are seeing increased sales, and this will only continue to grow as the popularity and knowledge of our region increases. We are thrilled at the opportunity to host the National Chandelier Research Society Group in June. Its members are from all over the world and are passionate about not only great food, but fine wine. And to have them visit the Willamette Valley is a true honor. Last month, I spent a week in New York City promoting the Willamette Valley and the Allison to such media outlets as O Magazine, InStyle, travel and leisure, as well as departure. The main purpose of the visit was to further encourage travel to Oregon, one region, by fostering relationship and endorsing all that we have to offer. In addition to meeting with the media, I also participated in an event with 50 of our local wineries to showcase some of the wines that are currently being produced in this region. 751 aficionados attended the event. Making the trip complete, myself and a colleague met with 25 of the top travel agencies to increase their knowledge of Oregon wine country and the surrounding area. When I moved to Oregon in 1994, I recall there had been less than 100 wineries. And now, 17 years later, there are 420 throughout our great state. The wine country license plate will play an instrumental role in helping to elevate the awareness of our area locally and to our yearly visitors. Additionally, the fund that will be generated will be a dedicated source to encourage tourism and promote Oregon wineries. Thank you for the time and consideration today.
Thank you. Sir, to be clear, I'm assuming you were here in support of the bill?
Yes.
Just to be clear.
Oh, absolutely.
The questions of... No questions? Thank you very much. Cheryl Belch?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Kelsch. I'm Executive Director of the Chehalem Valley Chamber of Commerce, and I also serve as President of Travel Yamhill Valley, Yamhill County's destination marketing organization. I'm here today representing both organizations that support and encourage your positive vote on Senate Bill 442. The Chehalem Valley Chamber of Commerce is made up of over 425 members in Newburgh, Dundee, and St. Paul. Travel Yamhill Valley has another 125 members, and that organization is completely a volunteer-managed organization. A significant percentage of our region's businesses are directly or indirectly impacted by tourism in Yamhill County. Chehalem Valley Chamber and McMinnville Chamber work very closely with Travel Yamhill Valley to attract visitors to our area. Travel Yamhill Valley's budgetary limitations have restricted our ability to proactively market the communities we represent. Senate Bill 442 provides a desperately needed source of revenue to develop and promote tourism product in Yamhill County, while also providing support to communities throughout Oregon. One of Travel Yamhill Valley's strongest assets is wine. However, we understand that a visitor to Oregon comes for a wide range of reasons, and it would be short-sighted to only focus on one of Oregon's assets. The majority of Oregon's destination marketing organizations are funded through lodging tax revenues, but that doesn't mean those funds are only used to promote hotels, motels, bed and breakfast, and camping. Those funds are used to promote all of Oregon's rich assets, and the lodging sector understands that they will be positively impacted with increased visitation. Senate Bill 442 is a statewide initiative to support education, workforce development, retraining, development, and promotion of an industry that will benefit all involved. Senate Bill 442 will provide a voluntary and significant revenue source to help all corners of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Next is Doug Wires.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Myers. I used to be a, sorry you couldn't read my writing. I'm a retired lobbyist. This is my first year of retirement. I used to represent groups like Water Watch, Trout Unlimited, Recyclers, Friends of the Gorge, and so forth. And I was honored to do so. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 442. My wife and I have lived in Salem for about 10 years now, and we have a second home in Montana now where we travel back and forth quite frequently. And one of our favorite gifts to give relatives and friends back there is Oregon Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris. And we've been honored to know several winemakers in the Willamette Valley, and I think this is a good way to contribute. That's it.
Thank you, Doug. Any questions? Thank you very much. Jamie Luch. Jimmy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
No.
And committee. My name is Jimmy Luke, and I'm the Executive Director of the Albany Visitors Association and the President of the Willamette Valley Visitors Association. My office is at 250 Broad Albin Street Southwest, Suite 110 in Albany. Travel Oregon recognizes seven regional destination marketing organizations here in Oregon. The Willamette Valley Visitors Association is one of those regional destination marketing organizations, encompassing the counties of Yamhill, Polk, Marion, Lynn, and Benton counties, East Lane County, and South Clackamas counties. For over 25 years, we have partnered to promote the region in an effort to attract day and overnight visitors, generating economic impact for this region and for the state of Oregon. Willamette Valley Visitors Association promotes all of the assets and attractions of the Willamette Valley region, including wine, culture, heritage, agriculture, recreation, natural attractions, culinary, family activities, and more. SB 442 is an entrepreneurial bill. It would place resources in the hands of the people in the trenches, working to build a better Oregon. We already work at the highest level with government-run programs and leverage their funding to build synergistic programs. But SB 442 will help to do that through a private nonprofit at a higher level by providing resources and educational opportunities to raise all tides. SB 442 will leverage the Willamette Valley Visitors Association's marketing efforts, Travel Oregon's efforts, the Oregon Wine Board's efforts, Oregon Destination Marketing Organization's efforts statewide, academic institutions, workforce development efforts, scholarships for Oregon residents, and Oregon's entrepreneurial efforts. All regions of the state will benefit from the bill, and it gets the dollars into every corner of the state through grants. This effort will not just be left up to one entity, it will be an Oregon movement by the people, not a state agency. Yes, the Willamette Valley will benefit from the initiative, but more importantly, so will all the other areas of Oregon. Currently, every dollar the Willamette Valley Visitors Association spends on attracting visitors to the valley also impacts all of the other regions of the state, because the only way to get to the Willamette Valley is through one of the other entry points in Portland, Eugene, Eastern Oregon, Southeastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, the Columbia Gorge, or from the Oregon coast. And we at the Willamette Valley Visitors Association are okay with that, because through our marketing efforts, our partner regions and destinations also succeed. Visitors travel through these communities, spending money and enjoying the tourism bounty here in Oregon. Since most of the visitors in the valley are automobile travelers, it is safe to say they are sightseeing and enjoying the Oregon experience and stopping for food, rest, and fuel along the way, touching all geographic regions of the state. Any concern that SB 442 is just a Willamette Valley initiative is unfounded. Grants will be available statewide. Willamette Valley Visitors Association has worked for the last several years to brand the Willamette Valley as Oregon Wine Country through our marketing efforts, and have trademarked that phrase for that purpose. Willamette Valley Visitors Association Board of Directors has given Cultivating Communities permission to use the phrase Oregon Wine Country for this initiative. On behalf of the Willamette Valley Visitors Association, I am pleased to support SB 442, and I ask that you support the bill also. The plates will provide resources to communities throughout Oregon for travel and tourism initiatives. These resources will go through a private nonprofit, Cultivating Communities, and will not add to the workload of the state agencies. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Thank you very much. Now, Austin. And then after that, Robert Kanaga?
Close.
You can come on up, too, if you'd like. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Austin McGuigan, and I'm the Community Development Director for Polk County. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 442. Polk County is a relatively small county with limited financial resources that is emerging as an important visitor destination for an increasing number of people with an interest in wine, local food, and value-added specialty farm products. Agritourism is an exciting economic benefit that reinforces and complements the agriculture sector. However, capturing the full benefit of tourism while preserving quality of life and the agricultural base takes considerable work by both industry and local government. We are very proud of what Polk County has to offer, but still struggle to finance vital projects that study and develop tourism-based policies, products, and infrastructure. We believe that the Wine Country Plate is an outstanding opportunity for the growing number of people who enjoy the agricultural bounty of our state to foster and develop a successful agricultural tourism sector link. Cultivating Communities' innovative strategy to help bolster economic growth and enhance Oregon's quality of life through travel and tourism initiative grants would provide an opportunity for Polk County to fund crucial projects that take advantage of promising tourism opportunities within our county. We hope that you will support Senate Bill 442 and the needed funding opportunities it would offer.
Thank you. Questions? Sir?
Yeah. For the record, my name is Robert Kanaga. You were close.
Close.
I'm on the executive board at Travel Lane County Board of Directors. I'm also the president of Oregon Mozart Players in Eugene. And in that capacity, for the last 3 years, I've driven the entire state getting one bottle of wine from every winery for our local auction. And in that task, I've got to visit as far as Forest Vineyard down in Cave Junction and Zevo and Milton Freewater and Flying Dutchman and Newport. And every winery is so important to Oregon. I was born here, raised here, watched the timber industry diminish slowly and watched the seed industry change. And to have something like this in our community, in our state, that creates such an impact, has such an important role economically, for employment, for everything else, it needs to be supported. And the license plate not only has the opportunity to bring in and make awareness of more tourism, but local tourism. Because you see that license plate around the state, there's a lot of people that don't know we have wineries here, that don't know the impact they have. And a plate like that, I think, would raise that awareness and do more good. So, obviously, I'm in support.
Questions?
Senator Stark. Real quick. Thank you. Mr.
Kanaga.
Kanaga, thank you. Just one real quick question. Obviously, you've been all over the state. You visit a lot of wineries all in every corner of the state. Mm-hmm. Are you at all concerned that the bill doesn't specify at all how the money would be spent? There's no guarantees in this bill, if we were to pass this legislation, that the money gets spent anywhere but perhaps in Marion County.
Actually, there is.
No, there is not how I read the bill.
50%, 35%, and...
I'm not certain that's in the bill.
Sir, that actually is not in the bill.
Ah.
It designates that the money would... That's in the testimony from community... What do we call it? Cultivating Communities. But this just says the money goes to Cultivating Communities.
Okay.
That's what the bill says.
Well, from what I understand, that money will be divided up around the state. I don't see the possibility or the feasibility of it being stuck in one place. Rationality would dictate that that wouldn't happen. So,
other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, the next three, I'll try that, is Byron Williams, Terry Sunderland, and Greg, I think it's Leo?
Greg Leo, right.
Ah. Whatever order you'd like to go.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Byron Williams. I'm the owner of Grand Cru Wine Tours, based at 814 Ashley Court in Monmouth, Oregon, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 442. I started Grand Cru Wine Tours to offer sustainable wine tours to those visiting Lane, Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. We work closely with local hotels, destination marketing organizations, and other businesses to offer a variety of options to those visiting our area. On each of our tours, we feature a variety of local meats, cheeses, and chocolates to not only feature the wineries, but also some of the other local agricultural and producers in the area. We've also collaborated with a number of organizations to offer stops on our tours that are not just wineries, such as some of the local breweries and the cheese tasting rooms. We feel this helps build agritourism in general and not just out of the wine industry. And we've come to rely on those supplemental businesses in our wine promotions. I wanted to speak today, just give you a brief exposure to our experiences with the guests that are visiting wine country and some of their reasons for coming into the area. I reviewed our records for 2010, and for our visitors to Lane County, 25% of those visitors were from out of state. However, none of those visitors had noted that the primary reason for their visit was to taste wine. Many of them were coming in for conventions, conferences that were in the area, or as a general vacation trip. I have one gentleman who spent one day with me wine tasting, was fly fishing the McKenzie River the next day, and then proceeded over to Bend to go hiking and camping throughout the high desert. It's those kind of experiences that we see frequently where, especially in Marion, Polk, and Lane counties, where individuals are coming as part of a larger trip and not just to visit wine country. And so this does, by bringing them in and encouraging them to visit wine country, helps promote all forms of tours in the area. The stats are slightly higher for Marion and Polk counties, with 50% of visitors coming from out of state, and about one-third of those visiting for the primary purpose of tasting wine. And in Yamhill County, about 40% of our guests were out of state, with 70% of those coming in for the primary purpose of tasting wine. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Terry Sunderland. I'm the general manager of Woodburn Company Stores, located at 1001 Arnie Road in Woodburn, Oregon. I am here to speak as a representative outside of the wine industry, and I will just share with you a few excerpts from a letter that hopefully is in your packet. As one of the largest attractions and employers in Oregon, and certainly the Willamette Valley, continued tourism support is of the utmost importance to our business. During the past few years of economic downturn and high unemployment rates, our business has actually increased in the past few years, in part because of domestic and international visitors. It's an avalanche effect that we rely on. Successful tourism programs and effective advertising need to be well-funded so they bring more visitors to the state and thus keep our business thriving, Oregonians employed, and bring even more new businesses to the table. We wholeheartedly support this tourism bill to provide a creative new funding mechanism to boost the economy and the entire tourism industry. The revenue splitting from our eyes is fair and balanced, providing the most support for those areas in the Willamette Valley that hold the larger quantity of not only wineries, but businesses and residents that rely on the travel and tourism industry. With the remaining regions of the state easily eligible to benefit from this initiative by applying for grants through the Cultivating Communities Organization, we strongly believe that there is no reason to not pass this bill. Thank you.
Any questions?
Just again, a follow-up. Thank you. Again, you referenced the split. There's no in the legislation, actual legislation. There's no specificity about how the money will be spent. Would you be more, or would you potentially object to if there was some more specificity in the bill as it relates to how the money might be spent across the state? As somebody who represents Western Washington County.
Right.
I know we've got great wineries in Washington County.
Ultimately, one of our perspectives as Woodburn Company Stores is that we fully believe in the state as a whole. And one of the things that I don't think a lot of people know is that we actually go on sales missions and send representatives from my company with the state and different regions of Oregon to just sell Oregon, because we know we're not going to Australia or China to sell probably outlet shopping in Oregon as much as I'd like to believe that. We understand the value of first selling our state, and I think that's really what this is all about, is just an initiative that helps support, strengthen the state's tourism. So I would say that I see your point, absolutely, and I would hope that the entire region benefits, I guess regardless if there is a split identified.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Chair Byers, members of the committee, my name is Greg Leo. I'm here in my capacity as chair of the Hospitality and Tourism Committee of the Wilsonville Chamber. We are a chamber of commerce of 400 businesses, which strongly believe that tourism is the front door of our economy. It may surprise you, but Wilsonville has 900 hotel rooms, and keeping those hotel rooms is critical to the economic health of our city. This year, the chamber has chosen the wine industry as our tourism initiative. We feel it has the greatest potential for bringing visitors both in-state and out-of-state to stay in Wilsonville. And frankly, we see ourselves as a gateway to Oregon wine country, as does Newburgh and our other collaborators. So with respect to Senator Starr's question about, you know, should this be earmarked for one particular group or another, tourism is a very collaborative industry where we work together and support each other. And so giving the money generally to this initiative, contemplated in Senate Bill 442, I think allows us the opportunity to work with the money to get the maximum benefit. So I would say simply a rising tide will carry all ships here. All of us will enjoy the benefits of increased tourism, filling our hotel rooms, and generally keeping Oregon a great place to visit.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Terry Westland, Bill Perry, and Mayor Ted Crawford.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 442. My name is Carrie Westland, and I'm employed as President and CEO of Travel Lane County. I serve on the Oregon Tourism Commission as past chair and also serve on the Statewide Tourism and Hospitality Consortium. The Travel Lane County Board of Directors, comprised of 38 representatives of business and government from across Lane County, endorses the establishment of a wine country license plate program as proposed in Senate Bill 442. In offering its full support, the board noted the innovative combination of branding through this beautiful full-color license plate, voluntary contributions through the selection and purchase of the optional license plate, and directed funding toward economic development through tourism and agritourism projects with marketing, educational, product development, and/or workforce development components. The tourism industry has invested in branding Oregon as a wine-producing destination for many years, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars annually through Travel Oregon's Fall Oregon Bounty Campaign, which was over $900,000 last year, promoting Oregon wine country through the Willamette Valley Visitors Association's trademark slogan, as Mr. Luke spoke to, and featuring Oregon at wine at trade shows and media events. The proposed wine license plate would add another marketing element that brands our state and provide support for this important agricultural activity that has significant crossover with tourism. We find the artwork, the proposed artwork, to be stunning and a representation of Oregon of which we can all be proud. Travel Lane County Board especially liked the idea of generating grant dollars for economic development from a voluntary consumer purchase as opposed to an industry tax or mandatory fee. We liked that the proposing organization would cover all administrative costs and not burden taxpayers, which I learned today is a requirement whether they wanted to or not, but they were certainly willing to do that. We liked that the grant program would be administered by a private nonprofit as opposed to establishing another government agency responsibility. We appreciate that the use of the license plate mechanism and state government as a partner, even with covering all of the admin fees, calls for a broad revenue share component. However, our support is not based on an expectation of future grant proceeds, and we support the Mid-Willamette Valley, where a majority of the state's wineries and wine production are located, receiving the bulk of the funds generated. My view is that the best projects should be the projects that get the grants, no matter where they're located. My understanding, though, is that Cultivating Communities is very open to amendment language that would incorporate percentage distributions if that would be more comfortable for the legislative body as it processes this bill. I've got a board roster attached to my letter. As you can see, I've got a wide range of businesses represented on my board, including the award-winning Iris Hill Winery, and they're all very much in support of this proposal. We hope it will have your full support, and we encourage the committee to move a do-pass recommendation. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Terry. Questions? Bill?
Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. We're here also in support of Senate Bill 442. I just wanted to touch on a few things that was brought up earlier. Ever since we got the statewide lodging tax back in 2003, you've heard mentioned today of a couple of lodging properties, the destination marketing organizations and others working together. And I do think that the one thing that has happened since 2003 is not only all those organizations, the industry, the DMOs, in the state have grown, but they've worked together. We've got a lot more grants. We've got a lot of different projects coming up. And I do want to say that we mentioned that there was about $8 billion in revenue that was generated in this industry. $1.6 billion of that is a food and beverage. They're the biggest benefactor of this. This is restaurants, wineries, and everything else. Transportation and fuel, you talked about people driving around the state, was $1.3 billion. $1.2 on accommodations. Retail sales was $900 million. Food stores were $500 million. So we see that as we talk about these grants, working together, getting the industry, the DMOs, and the state all working together, getting more money into this, benefits everybody. And when you look at the past projects that have been successful for Travel Oregon was Oregon Bounty, if you've seen the cookbooks, and Vintner's Bounty. Tourists that come usually for restaurant, culinary tourisms, or wine tend to spend twice as much as other tourists. And so this really is a focal point to try to get destination marketing organizations like this will basically become to try to get people to come either on wine, food and beverage, or anything else is going to increase for everybody. It's going to increase all segments of the economy. So we like this because, as it's been said, it's voluntary. It's getting more money into the system, but it's not necessarily coming from anybody in particular. It's a voluntary contribution. And when you look at the people that will be targeted, whether in one area or else, they will be generating revenues for many different segments of the economy. So anything that we can do to try to encourage voluntary contributions into this process is just going to grow it even more than it has over the last 6 to 8 years. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Bill. Questions? Mayor Crawford.
Hey, Chairman Byer, members of the committee, I'm Ted Crawford, Mayor of the City of Dundee. In addition to my letter of support that I submitted with Cultivating Communities, I wanted to share with you some facts that substantiate Dundee's claims as the heart of wine country. According to the Oregon Press, two of the five largest wineries by production and a third winery in Dundee is the eighth largest. So, and also the third largest winery in 2010 production is going to move its operations just outside the border of Dundee. So, in effect, we have four of the 10 largest wineries and three of the five largest wineries in the state. And together, they produce about 2.6 million bottles of wine a year. And if you take a $20 price per bottle, that equates to about $50 million of wine production in the city of Dundee. Also, there are about 30 to 35 wineries that are within a five-mile radius of my city, and so that's easily close to $100 million a year is generated in revenue and wine.
That's a lot of wine.
Yeah, and although that's not all targeted towards tourists, it does serve restaurants throughout the state, and the wine is sent internationally. Also, around this wine industry, there's about seven restaurants, six tasting rooms, and all these clearly benefit from tourism activity in my community. And Dundee has a 120-room hotel that provides some revenue for tourism promotion. However, revenue provided by Senate Bill 442 will greatly aid in tourism promotion and will have a very positive economic impact on my community. So I highly encourage your support of Senate Bill 442.
I guess I have one question to the panel, since you're up here. Is the bill obviously, if it goes forward, needs a little bit of work. The 10,000 is not the right number. We need a different, but the designating of a nonprofit, why would we do that as opposed to, say, the Travel Council, the existing one, or something like that?
The Oregon Tourism Commission.
Tourism, yeah.
Well, I actually think the nonprofit should be commended, Chair Beyer, for coming up with the idea. It was an idea born out of need, because the Mid-Willamette Valley, as you've just heard the mayor say, does not have capacity for destination marketing the way other parts of the state do. And they came up with this idea as a way to generate funds. And so that's why their background papers show a relationship to the wine industry in terms of how those project funds get distributed so that they can beef up their marketing programs. There have been conversations around who would be best to administer the funds. Our organization certainly likes the idea of that being done in the private sector rather than tasking the government agency with additional work. We do have a grant program within Travel Oregon. It's a very modest grant program, so we're pretty excited at the idea of a secondary grant program coming to life and not being confined by the parameters within the current state agency, to be quite frank. We can look outside the strategies of Travel Oregon and do some additional project work and not be constrained by that one organization's view in terms of where the priority should lie.
Any other questions?
After the testimony from the mayor, I'm just feeling really thirsty.
Do you have other questions? Thank you very much. The last person I have is Ken Wright.
Thank you, Chair Byron. Committee members, I'd like to contest the Mayor of Dundee's assertion that Dundee is the heart of Oregon wine country. I give that to Carlton. But I thank you for allowing me to come before you today. I've been involved in the wine industry for many years, 10 in California and the last 25 here. I own Ken Wright Cellars in Carlton, Oregon, but we have 10 vineyards throughout the Willamette Valley, scattered all over. I've been the chair of Salud. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it's an organization that provides health care for migrant labor for our industry, and chaired it for 6 years in the 90s. I chaired the Gam Hill Carlton Viticultural Area, created and authored the paper that created the AVA. And I currently chair Walk in the Park, which is essentially an outdoor festival that has been the last 8 years held in Carlton, brings 5,000 people to an outdoor art festival to a town of 1,800. I want to talk a little about tourism dollars, because the reality, you heard some numbers from the mayor, and they sounded impressive when you're talking millions of dollars, but let's talk profitability, and the profitability is very different than creating money. Our only profitable sale, truly, essentially, is the retail sale. When we sell out of country, and I'm selling to Japan, I'm selling to Taiwan, I'm selling all over the world, I'm selling in 40 states, I'm not making money in those sales. I'm essentially creating a base, and a knowledgeable base, that we exist, and that helps. But my hope is that those people in those countries and other states eventually visit me and buy retail. All the profitability in our industry is really comes from that. So the health of the wine industry really is based on tourism, hugely. It's really the basis of our health. And so I applaud Angie Morris and her group for this great concept. We actually have a wine board. I was the member of the wine board in the 80s. And we've had a marketing committee for 30 years that never came up with this idea. It's a little disappointing. And so good for Angie for coming up with it. And what there's so many things to like about it. It's not taking money from anywhere else. It's not redirecting money. It's new money. And it's budget neutral. I like that a lot. And And I also would, I would hope, I understand the that there's a concern on Senator Starr's part about how those funds would be allocated. And I do share your concern on that point. And in the Cultivating Communities fact sheet, you know, they list 50% going to Marion Polk and Yamhill, 35% out, and then 15% administration. I like that. That's, if that's what Cultivating Communities wants to do, I'm all for it. But I think it should be in the bill. I do not, however, like the idea of having any other organization manage those dollars. I think Cultivating Communities, this is their essence. This is what they want to do. This is their creativity, their idea. They want to run with it. They'll have time to do it correctly. I think we should give them, they've got the energy, let them do it, and they'll do it well. I think that's really about it. Thank you.
No, other than just thank you for taking the time to come and testify. I've enjoyed your facility in Carleton as well.
So, oh, thank you. Please come again.
And buy lots. It's the only way it's going to be profitable.
Exactly correct.
So, thank you. Amy, did you wish to comment again?
And Mr. Chair, can I make a request on the record here?
You sure can.
And this goes to the Cultivating Communities. If apparently we're not going to move the bill today, and I think that's good, but would it be possible to get a list of your board of directors and your incorporating papers so that we have that as part of the record? That would be really helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Chair Byron, members of the committee, thank you for indulgence testifying again specifically to the bill, Senate Bill 442. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, DMV, handing out written testimony. Just want to hit two main points. Thank you, Chair Byer, for acknowledging that the $10,000 number probably needs some work in the bill to accommodate the additional costs that can't come from the highway fund. And secondly, the existence of the wine plate does call into question a bit the existence of DMV's current administrative rule that prevents folks from having alcoholic beverages or drugs on their custom plate verbiage that people ask for. We've fought court battles over that. So I just raise it as a point, as something to be considered and that will need to be dealt with going forward if the bill were to move. Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions?
I don't really have an additional question, just another comment, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
So, and it's for the proponents of the bill, just to be aware, there are other license plate bills that are being proposed in this legislature. And I don't, you know, we have as a committee haven't tackled the license plate idea generally. So that's something to be aware of. Would you support other folks having other license plates? If you look at the data, it's the numbers have been going down over the last few years of people, citizens buying specialty plates. There seems to be in the neighborhood of, you know, 45,000 to 60,000 specialty plates that are sold, and whether there's three or four plates available. And you know, just to temper the enthusiasm just a little bit about this is a pot of gold at the end of some rainbow, so, and having a marketing plan and business plan about how to get the word out, you're most likely going to mean that you're going to take money out of another specialty plates column as opposed to maybe increasing that pie in the event that there's only 315,000 plates total sold. So for the record, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. That's all I have signed up. Just a second. Is there anybody else who's here who wishes to testify on this?
Can I make a comment?
Go ahead, Senator.
I've been kind of quiet through the whole thing. First of all, I think this is a really good bill. And I actually started thinking about Senator Starr's comment about trying to divide out the 50-35. But then if you take it to that point, how are you going to divide out the 35? And so it might be a nest that it creates more problems than it's worth in trying to separate it out. So I'll vote for it no matter how it comes out. But for example, Marion County is included in this. I also represent Clackamas and Linn County. Are you going to, I mean, and Senator Starr represents Washington County. How are you going to divide out the 35% and see that done? So it could be a place that we might not, if you, You might want to think about it a little bit. I'm not saying that it's wrong to do that. I'm not saying it's right, but there is some problem in trying to spell it out in statute.
Well, as the bill is written, it's not in statute.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying, is it?
The concept there is that even if you did the 50 and 35, it's their problem, the way it's written.
Yeah. But I do think that you have to change the ODOT part of this,
right?
The bill for sure, because $10,000 is not going to cover it. So that you don't want to lock that into statute. So there are things that have to be changed.
Right. Absolutely. And I think they're aware of that. If there's no other testimony, we do have some to read into the record.
I want to note for the record there was a fiscal impact, but we have no revenue impact issued at this point on this bill. We also got written testimony on behalf of two people, one from the Southern Oregon Visitors Association representing the association. The association does not support Senate Bill 442.
Say that again?
This is the Southern Oregon Visitors Association, CEO Carol Hill, and Carolyn, I'll pass that out for you. That organization does not support or endorse Senate Bill 442. And then I also have a memo from Oregon Wine Growers Association, and you can read it. It looks like they appear not to support the current language, but support the concept. So you guys can look over their written testimony.
Thank you.
See what they discuss.
All righty. Nobody else? We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 442, and we will, we're down to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 537.
Would you like me to read into the...
Yes, Richard, please.
Okay, Senate Bill 537 permits a local government to authorize, limit, or impose conditions on growth at airports when it's related to basing additional helicopters. There's no revenue impact, and there's minimal expenditure impact. And Carolyn's bringing up the sheet.
All righty, first up I have Kerry... Richter?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. My name is Carrie Richter. I'm an attorney representing NAVE, Neighbors Against Apple Valley Expansion. We are proponents of Senate Bill 537, working with Washington County and Senator Johnson's office favoring this bill. We have been working tirelessly to limit airport expansion activities on the Apple Valley Airport, which is 1 mile south of Buxton near US 26 in Washington County in the sort of narrow Apple Valley. The airstrip was constructed in 1994 by Rod Anderson, also known as Ramblin' Rod to Portland TV viewers, to accommodate his private airplane and infrequent owners and invited guests. In 1995 and 1997, the Oregon legislature passed legislation requiring local jurisdictions to adopt an airport planning program for airports described in ORS 836-660-ETSEC. In 2003, the county designated the Apple Valley Airport within the Airport Overlay District, which is defined in Section 385 of the Washington County Community Development Code. Because of its inclusion in the Airport Overlay District, Apple Valley Airport is now considered a private use airport and not a personal use airport, and subject to ORS 836-608, which is where these amendments are proposed. This designation allows the airport many exemptions from planning and zoning laws that wouldn't otherwise apply. In 2004, Mike and Jenny Appleby purchased the property and airstrip from the estate of Anderson. In 2005, the owners announced plans to convert the airstrip into a commercial operation that would provide flight instruction and scenic flight tours, and began using the airport for pilot training, aircraft sales, commercial scenic tours, and helicopter use. The owners were issued enforcement citations for expanding the airport activities in violation of the county code. In an effort to resolve the enforcement proceeding, in 2006, the owners filed an application with the county to expand the existing operation and establish new uses within the airport. This application was denied, and the Applebee's appealed the denial to the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals. LUBA held that the Applebee's were allowed to conduct agricultural and fire protection operations, as well as their own personal activities, on the airstrip consistent with Rocky Anderson's 1995 use, coupled with the unlimited expansion of aircraft, including helicopters, to serve these purposes, but new uses, such as commercial scenic tours or pilot training, were new uses that required land use review. In October 2008, the Applebee's received approval for the construction of a 17,000-square-foot aircraft hangar, a 36,500-square-foot concrete helicopter landing pad, and an 18,500-square-foot gravel vehicle and aircraft parking staging area. This suggests the idea was not to maintain a personal use aircraft. Nave appealed this decision to LUBA, and LUBA remanded the decision to the county, finding that the hangar area would be outside the airport overlay area. So this is where we sit today. Nave remains gravely concerned about the negative impacts associated with the Applebee's efforts to expand this airport in ways that are entirely excessive for a small private rural airport in a narrow valley on property that is highly prone to flooding, surrounded by rural lands, including a local school, the recently designated L.L. Stubb Stewart State Park, and the many rural properties that are used to stable and pasture livestock and horses, both privately and commercially. Yet at any one time, three or more training helicopters can be seen parked on the property along with a UH-1B Huey N99021 on Apple Valley, which does not retain a rural character unless we are remembering Vietnam in the 1960s. Neighbors have reported their horses being startled into a run when the Huey flies into the Apple Valley. As currently drafted, ORS 836-608-3D prohibits local governments from limiting the number of aircraft or the amount of flight activity associated with a permitted use. Aircraft is defined to include a full range of air vehicles, including helicopters. Nave has been working with Washington County and Senator Johnson's office to change this provision so that adding helicopters that were not already approved would require review as a new use. That would require consideration of how the proposed use, the helicopters, would impact existing uses on the surrounding airport. That inquiry is not required now. We also ask that this prohibition on helicopters be effective immediately rather than waiting until this bill takes effect. We thank you for your consideration of this request. We understand that Nave representatives were unable to be here today, and we have asked that you take this up again next Monday, if you would please. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Ms. Richter? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim McCauley.
Chair Beyer, committee members, for the record, Jim McCauley, representing Washington County. I have Chris Gilmore with County Council here on my right, and he's here to answer any of the legal questions for you that you might have by the time I get through. Let me introduce this first as a bill that we're trying to essentially help out the communities that do have airports in them. Again, primarily small airports that are covered under the airport planning guidebook that was put together in 2003. There's actually a specific list. It's in the testimony in your comments. So it's relatively narrow in terms of what airport physically would qualify for this type of amendment. But nevertheless, that's what we've confined this to. So bottom line is our planning staff have had the experience of trying to go through this process with an existing airport, Apple Valley, and quite honestly, there is no public input opportunity in that process for them. So the recommendation that we have in our amendment in Senate Bill 537 is to narrow this to helicopters specifically. We believe that the fixed-wing aircraft essentially is a different type of aircraft, obviously. They're confined to the runway. They're confined to a certain flight pattern. Helicopters typically have an ability that is virtually unlimited. They don't have to enter the same pathway or leave the same pathway or even land similar to an airplane. And they also present probably the greatest influence or impact to some of the surrounding neighbors because of their ability to hover and utilize that immediate airspace, whereas we don't find that same experience with airplanes. So under the proposed amendments, what you will find is when additional helicopters are added to an existing airport within this list, it kicks it into a Type 3 planning process, and the counties would develop essentially criteria for reviewing that conditioned use. Typically what that would mean for us in Washington County, we would look at the time of operation, a flight path type of designation, essentially to try to limit the type of neighborhood incursions that you might expect without something like that being in place. There also obviously is an opportunity for public input, hearings officer, and something that is a little bit more formalized process.
Jim, you're referencing proposed amendments. I'm assuming you mean the bill as it is.
The bill as it is.
You don't have any amendments out there anywhere?
Well, there is a suggestion of an amendment out there to make this retroactive to January 2011 because this went through the whole process, an applicant could come in prior to this taking effect and essentially get themselves in the queue and therefore not qualify them for that, for this type of...
Just in order to be clear, we don't have any amendments in front of us.
So. Right.
Okay. All right.
So I'll be happy to take any questions right now.
Any questions? Senator.
Yeah, just real quick. What are the unintended consequences here? Clearly, we have a situation in Washington County, but we're passing statute that affects every corner of the state of Oregon. So I'm careful. I want to be cautious about doing that. I mean, do we have any indication from other counties that they're supportive or opposed to this bill? Are there helicopter owners association, probably not, but some group of helicopter owners that are concerned about passing this that creates a situation that makes it difficult for them to operate?
Right. Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, I haven't received any direct opposition from any groups. I suspect the owner of Apple Valley won't be pleased with this new step. But I can tell you that we haven't received any opposition from the existing counties. We haven't received it from AOC, okay, for example, at this point.
And Chair Bynes, Senator Starr, if I could just add, the proposed bill...
Starr, for the record, please.
Yes, thank you, Chris Gilmore, County Council for Washington County. The proposed bill makes a change in process, not an outcome. So effectively what it does is when you add an additional helicopter, instead of it being added outright, you go through a process and apply standards that give local government an ability to look at mitigation and potential for conditions. And that discretion is not unlimited. And what already exists in the Airport Planning Act is that all conditions have to be clear and objective. So it does give local government a little bit more ability to problem solve in terms of dealing with conflicts, but that would be applied uniformly throughout the state, and it doesn't necessarily, as I said, prohibit any uses or your ability to grow or expand. It's mostly a change in process.
Okay. Senator Drum.
Thank you, Chair Barr. Actually, I think it goes further than a change of process. And you take Apple Valley, and I think they made a purchase in good faith, and they invested money, and the county and the airport doesn't like what they're doing, but they did it under the current rules. You guys have lost. You're in here now trying to change the rules so that you can win. That kind of bothers me as someone that thinks that the land use problem is really convoluted, and for people to get out there and actually make investments, it's really tricky. So I share Senator Starr's feeling about this. I understand your problem, and I sympathize, but to me, as Senator Beyer said, the horse has left the barn, and you want to put the horse back in the barn with different rules. And so to lock this into statute that it affects the whole state over one single land use issue, I feel kind of sympathetic to Apple Valley because I've been on the other end of it. So I'm not saying I'm a no vote, but I'm really strongly leaning that way.
Yeah. Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, I totally understand. I mean, this is an incredibly sensitive issue. We appreciate that. We don't want to stop airports from expanding. That certainly isn't our intent. I think the only thing I can probably add is just to restate what we're after here is to offer an opportunity for a neighboring community or neighbors to be able to provide some input as uses change. We're looking at people who have been in this area for a number of years, and I suspect there probably are other conflicts throughout the state. It's just that we haven't heard about them, or because there is physically no opportunity to go forward without something like these type of changes. But I appreciate your comments.
Thank you, gentlemen. We're going to bring this back next week. I think Monday we've got it scheduled for, but I wonder, Mitch, did you want to comment on this now or wait until then?
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, you can come right now and then be able to answer questions.
You might be able to answer Senator Starr's question. I do recognize that I have two more bills to get through today. So,
Chairman, if you don't mind, I'd like to invite Chris Cummings. He's our land use planning manager.
Sure.
To come up as well.
For the record, I'm Mitch Swecker, the acting director of the Department of Aviation. I have written testimony here that I will provide to you if you have not seen it already. Senate Bill 537 does amend 836.608 to limit growth, especially as it relates to helicopters. This is legislation that at one time 836.600 through 836.630 was put in place in 1995 basically to protect rural airports statewide. It was amended in 1997 to include privately owned public airports and private airports as well. Just to go to the summary at the bottom here, this is a statewide application to address Senator Starr's question. This does apply across the board in the state, and there are a number of helicopter operations in the state of Oregon. Oregon is one of the heavy lift capitals of the United States right now, with Columbia helicopters at Aurora. There's the one in
there's one in Southern Oregon.
HTS, which is going to be working out of Aurora as well. And then there's one at what's the name of the one I'm thinking of?
Evergreen.
So there are a number of large helicopter companies, and helicopters are used throughout the state for agriculture, spraying Christmas trees, that sort of thing. So there's impacts that may be felt statewide. We're neutral on this bill, and we're here primarily as a reference for you for questions. And if we can answer any today, we stand by to do that.
With your last statement, I'm wondering why you're neutral on the bill.
It's just a statement of fact. It could impact throughout the state, any helicopter companies throughout the state that have land use issues similar to what's at Apple Valley.
Senator Jordan?
Thank you, Chair Beyer. The district I live in or represent historically has been called the helicopter district. I mean, we have a lot of Christmas trees. We're very and timber, and we're dependent on helicopters. So, you know, any chance that this might impinge on helicopters, I'm a little bit sensitive to.
Anything else? Senator Stark.
So just real quickly, I own a helicopter. I don't, but if I did, could I land that helicopter anywhere that I could find the footprint big enough to land it?
Where there is no objection, you could conceivably do that.
So that doesn't constitute an airport?
It's not an airport or a heliport. The process for getting approval for a new heliport like this goes through the counties. We do work with the counties on that. It also goes through the FAA. They have to submit a form for that, and it's not approved. We only look at it from a safety perspective, but it's really the counties that have the final authority on whether a new airport or heliport goes in, as long as it meets safety standards and FAA standards.
So, Mr. Chair, you intend to bring this bill back, so I don't need to answer all my questions since we got other bills to go.
Is okay, thank you. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to testify on this today? We will bring it back next week. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 537, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 259. Richard?
Senate Bill 259 declares provisions in motor carrier transportation contract that indemnifies a party to that contract against liability for acts of the other party to be void. It declares an emergency. There's no revenue impact and there's no expenditure impact. We also have a -1 amendment, and we have no revenue and no expenditure on that amendment.
And we've lost Bob.
But you have you have the president. You have the president.
I know. Do you want to take a shot at it? I don't think there's any opposition.
No, there isn't, but he would have been far more eloquent. For the record, Deborah Dunn, I'm the president of the Oregon Trucking Association, so thank you for hearing me, Senator Beyer, and members of the committee. This bill was introduced, I guess we actually had some support for it a couple sessions ago. It's being reintroduced as part of a nationwide effort to see if we can't get the entire country to have a anti-indemnification bill on there, or the statute, in their rosters. Here's why. Companies all over the country are signing contracts, trucking companies are signing contracts where they're being asked to indemnify their shippers in a contract agreement. And this makes an unfair playing field, is the bottom line. It puts the carrier in a position where they feel obligated to sign that contract so they can get the business. And at the same time, if something were happened, let's say on the shipper's property, a good example is if the forklift driver of a shipper were to run over the foot of a driver, a trucking company owner driver, or run into their truck, we basically indemnified that shipper from being responsible for our property or the injury of our employee. So what we're asking in this bill is just to level the playing field and to say that if we enter into a contract with a shipper, if it's our fault, it's our fault. If it's the shipper's fault, it's the shipper's fault. We're both going to take responsibility for that. In some 27 states around the country have passed similar legislation with little or no opposition. In fact, Bob probably in his materials has a shipping map for you so that you can see those states that have passed this legislation. So that's a very broad summary of what the bill does.
Did you address the -1 at all?
Pardon me?
I
don't have a copy of those.
You don't have copies?
No. Like I said, Bob may have a copy. He ran up to Senator Fagerling's office.
Maybe you can answer it. I'll give you a copy.
Okay.
There he comes.
Ah, there he is.
Okay, I have a pitch hitting here.
Mr. Russell, your boss is just doing an excellent job, but she's not sure if she can explain the dash ones.
Have you seen the dash ones?
I can do the dash ones.
Okay.
Okay, the Ocean Carrier Equipment Management Association, which is an association that basically exists for the purpose of establishing an agreement between the trucking industry and the steamship lines over the use of container chassis. So we're not actually transporting the container chassis, but we're using the container chassis to transport the containers from the ports to destination and from shippers back to the ports. And often the steamship company is not even present when we pick them up. So there has been this national agreement for years and years, and it has an indemnification clause in it that the steamship companies have insisted on because they're not even there when we're picking up the chassis. So what this amendment would do would say that their agreement is exempt from the provisions of this bill. That's all it does.
Okay. Questions?
No questions.
Thank you both. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Seeing none, we have the fiscal and all that explained.
For both.
We will, let's see here, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 259 and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 259.
Mr. Chair
moves the dash 1 to 25, Senate Bill 259. Is there any opposition? Dash 1 is adopted. Senator Starr, did you want to move the bill?
Yeah, I just move Senate Bill 259 as amended by the dash 1 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves 259 to the floor as amended. Discussion. Is there any opposition? There is none. Senate Bill 259 is moved to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Senator Starr, would you carry?
Certainly.
Thank you. Senator Starr is a carrier. We will now open on, I got to get to my right place here. We will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 877. Richard.
Senate Bill 877 directs the Oregon Department of Transportation to adopt rules implementing the Oregon Coordinate System. It requires the Oregon Department of Transportation to establish an advisory committee before adopting rules required by this measure. It has no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
And we have Ron Singh and John Putnam. This one looks really, really technical.
You think?
Short version. Let me ask before you start, are there amendments to this?
There will be an amendment that's in the Legislative Council, hasn't come out
yet. It isn't out yet.
It isn't out yet.
All right, so we're not going to move the bill today then.
Correct.
All right. So go ahead.
So good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Ron Singh. My address is 12425 Northwest Marshall Street, Portland, Oregon, 97229. And I'm going to talk about Senate Bill 877, but I need to at least declare that I work for the Oregon Department of Transportation, but I'm here as a private individual representing the committee. And if there are questions that require me to put on my ODOT hat, I'd be willing to do that. But all my presentation will be as a private individual supporting the bill, representing the Oregon Coordinate Reference System Technical Development Team. So this coordinate system was developed by a public, private, and academic partnership. And on the back of my testimony, I have the list of people who were on this team developing the coordinate system. What I'd like to do is take, and I realize we are pushed for time, so I'll be very brief, but I'd like to take a few moments to explain what the coordinate system is and why we needed it, and then I'll talk a little bit about what the bill does, and probably, more importantly, what it does not do. So as surveyors and engineers and cartographers and now geographic information professionals, we identify features and objects on the planet, on maps, on a coordinate system, or using coordinates. The Earth that we live on is obviously not flat. It took us a while to figure that out, but when you take features on...
It's going to come as a shock to a number of people.
If you take features that are on this semi-round spherical planet that we have, and you project it onto a flat map, you're introducing distortion. And so there's many ways to... You cannot eliminate the distortion, but there's many ways to minimize it. And all of our engineering efforts, and I'll talk specifically about civil engineering and surveying, but all the engineering efforts are done on a planar coordinate system, but the planet is spheroid. So if you were to imagine a globe that is, let's say, made of glass with the light bulb in the center, and the globe has the planet, the features etched on it, and you imagine when you turn that light bulb on, the shadows that is cast on the wall is greatly distorted. If you move that globe close to and touch the wall at one point, the touching point has no distortion or very minimal distortion, but the rest of it as you move away has tremendous distortion. So we take our features that are on a round system and put it onto a plane, and we've been doing that for a very long time. The Oregon State Plane Coordinate System was developed in 1938, and actually it began in North Carolina at the request of a highway department engineer, and the federal agency that is now the National Geodetic Survey came into North Carolina and created a coordinate system for them so that they could relate all their projects in the state to each other. So much like having a jigsaw puzzle where each little piece being a project, it fits together. That system has been around for 75 years, and it has significant distortion in it, especially in Oregon, because a larger factor of distortion is created by elevation or by height. So this issue, when it was developed, was well within tolerances of the equipment that you could use to measure, within the reasons for accuracy relating to land values, etc. Over time, land values have increased. Engineering projects are getting a lot more complex. Measurement accuracies are increasing. And now with all this automated machine control where we are able to take designs, plug it into a bulldozer, and the bulldozer essentially builds your roadbed for you, this distortion becomes intolerable. So a couple of years ago, in about 2008, I took the idea of creating a new high-performance, low-distortion projection system to the Oregon surveying community, to the GIS community, and anybody else that's involved with it. And there was a lot of very positive feedback, so we decided to embark on creating a new system. So I put together a team, which I mentioned is listed on the back. We have people from the government sector, from the private sector, and from academia. And we developed a series of low distortion projections for the state of Oregon, and we call that the Oregon Coordinate Reference System, or OCRS. And we have essentially completed it in the summer of 2010, and the last step in our series of plans was to basically put it into the law. And so that's where we are now. The bill essentially does several things. Firstly, it legitimizes it for and provides a viable acceptance amongst the engineering, surveying, and mapping professionals. And the National Geodetic Survey, that's a federal agency, they require series of steps to be put into place for any state that's going to create new coordinate systems. For them to support it, they require a series of steps, and one of them is they want it legislated. So what the bill does is essentially it requires ODOT to create an Oregon administrative rule so that we can put all these technical definitions, which are just nothing but a series of numbers and formulas, into a document that can be managed accordingly. Right now, ORS Chapter 93 has the definitions for this 75-year-old coordinate system. It's in Chapter 93. But Chapter 93 is conveyancing and recording, which has nothing to do with coordinate systems, but that's where they put it for whatever reason and at the time they did this. And so we felt we needed to place all these new coordinate definitions somewhere, and Chapter 93 didn't appear to be the right place to put it. So that's why we are suggesting the OAR, and we want to pull the existing definitions that are in Chapter 93 out and put it into the OAR and put all these new coordinate definitions in that OAR. Since the OAR would be an Oregon DOT OAR, there were folks in the community that felt that they would like to have a hand in managing it, and so we put into the bill that it would be managed by a committee consisting of, and it lists the various organizations that that would be in there.
So why is this ODOT's responsibility?
Well, because there, Chair Beyer, because there is no agency responsible for the statewide infrastructure across the state, and because there is no, because ODOT does have an infrastructure, we have horizontal and vertical control infrastructure across the whole state, and because the original state plane coordinate system was developed for the highway departments in those days, that's why we feel it's appropriate.
Just curious, it seemed like an add-on.
So the bill essentially requires the creation of the OAR, requires a committee to administer it. It moves all the definitions from 93 into the OAR. It moves all the definitions of the new coordinate systems that we have into this OAR. And then we had to make some modifications to OAR 209 and, ORS 93, ORS 209, and ORS 390 to simply redirect the language that used to point to 93 for the definitions now will point elsewhere to the OAR. And then we also update some obsolete language in the Chapter 93 that refers to Federal Geodetic Control Committee that doesn't exist anymore. So we're just making some changes there. What the bill does not do is it does not force anyone to use the OCRS. It does not have any negative fiscal impact on any agency, any private firm, no matter how small or large that private firm is. And on the contrary, it really does things that we should have been doing for a long time. For example, today when we do surveys and engineering projects, they are not related to each other precisely in the way that you can actually engineer from. For example, whichever district you're in, if you imagine a project in that district, it really doesn't relate to adjacent projects with the accuracy that you need to actually do engineering work from. So if you think of the Portland area, TriMet may be building light rails, ODOT may be building highways, somebody else building something else, and those surveys and those engineering projects do not fit.
So this is only going to relate to transportation?
No, sorry. This is going to open the coordinate system to anyone for any use.
Is it going to affect meets and bounds for real estate markers or anything else?
No, that would continue. The meets and bounds descriptions are not affected by it. As a matter of fact, one of the changes to the that's in the bill, it allows anyone to use these new coordinate systems wherever they were allowed to use the old state plane coordinate system. So it just simply says you can now also use these, but it doesn't change any meets and bounds descriptions or anything else.
All right. Senator Girard.
I got a few questions.
At the risk of really getting in too deep here.
I know, this is a pretty complex bill. If it doesn't, you're saying it doesn't cost anything.
Yes.
It's not going to cost ODOT a dime to do this?
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, we have worked on this as an ODOT initiative to solve some internal problems we've had with our coordinate systems. As I mentioned, we are now into doing things like machine control, where bulldozers are using our designs and actually building roads. And in order to facilitate all of that, we had to solve the problems with distortions. So we've been working on that for a long time, and we actually created a system back in the 1940s that somewhat did that, but it needed to be changed. So we've actually done the work to take care of our issues and solve our problems. What this does is it allows anyone outside of ODOT to also use it for anything that they'd like to use.
I'm suspecting that this one might, there may be more questions when we come back, because that brings us back again.
Well, I still got a couple here.
Huh?
I still got a couple questions.
Well, have at it.
All right. Why do we have to do it by statute then? If it doesn't cost ODOT anything, what's the reluctance on ODOT to do the bill without, why do you need to put it in a statute?
Chair Meyer and Senator Girard, we could have done this completely internally and not involved anyone else in the development of it or enabled them to use it. However, I'm trying to figure out how to answer your question best, but we utilize it, and we have been utilizing it for a year or so, but it doesn't stop us from doing all of our engineering projects. However, people that want to do things that the law allows them to do today, that points to the state plane coordinates, will allow them to use this also. And I'm sure if I've answered your question well enough.
Well, not really. But
can you take another stab?
It's a good stab.
Nope. Take a stab.
Okay.
And I got one final question.
Okay.
Oh, have at it.
Oh, hey, this is technical. I like science, but I was just on the Big Island, and they were talking about the height of one of the mountains fluctuates 4 feet with the phase of the moon. How technical are you going to get with your distortion problem?
That's a hell of a lot. I got the question.
This does not address any sort of coordinate undulations that are occurring. In Oregon, we do have movement, but that's addressed by adjusting the coordinate system on some sort of a frequency.
So I just want to make sure I fully understand. This is going from a three-dimensional object to a two-dimensional object. That's all we're talking about. Is that correct?
Correct. Every engineering work that we do on the civil side is working on a coordinate system, and we may call it a 3D coordinate system, but essentially the horizontal positioning is on a plane. It's like on a flat piece of paper.
Yeah.
And then you have elevation that goes with it. So the method that's used to flatten is called a projection, and different techniques are used to project it. And the system that was developed in the 1930s used a technique that yielded an accuracy of worst case was 1 in 10,000, or 1 part in 10,000, so 1 foot in 10,000 feet. But it didn't consider elevation. When you add elevation in, the distortion is much more significant. So what we're doing is we're creating these projections that represent the ground. So there's virtually no difference between the grid and the ground. So if you measure 100 feet on the ground, it'll be 100 feet on your coordinate system. And that's the intent of this.
With the computers that we have now, I don't understand why we're so concerned about converting the 3D to 2D when it could be just left more three-dimensional on the computer. Am I missing? It would seem to me like. Well, go ahead.
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard. And I'm struggling because I'm trying to keep it very
simple,
quick, and not very technical. However, what I will mention is, someday I believe there will be a true 3D coordinate system that we will all engineer on. Today, we as surveyors can do it, and that system is an Earth-centered, Earth-fixed system, where the center of your coordinate system is the center of the mass of the planet. And then the three axes is one that goes out through the equator at 0 degrees longitude, 190 degrees left of it, and one through the North Pole. So wherever you may be on the planet or in space, you have a true 3D coordinate system. But that's not what all of our engineering is done on. Because if you use those coordinates, you still have to figure out which way water flows, and so on. And so we're getting into some very It'll take a lengthy conversation if you'd like for me to continue.
Shut up.
We could get into this discussion again because I'm missing a couple many members when we come back with the amendments. So if I could ask your indulgence, could we put off further testimony until then, unless you don't want to come back again?
Do we know when that's going to happen?
No, I can come back anytime.
I think
yours is very short.
Yeah, so. You know, I can probably get mine over real quick.
Okay.
My name is John Putnam. I'm the president of Orion Geomatics. I am one of the members on the team that created this, but I also am a small business owner in Washington County. We provide our services up and down the West Coast in the United States. Currently, probably for the last 13 years, we've been developing our own system similar to this on a project-by-project basis. As Ron alluded to, there is no way that I can use, most of our stuff is for engineering projects. Engineering works mostly rail, some transportation, highway transportation, but doing this allows us to give the engineering something that they can go out and measure on the ground to make it simple, a 100-foot or 200-foot rag chain or tape. You can get the same measurement that we can measure with our GPS. Technically, since the GPS is measuring on a curved surface, if you use a state plane coordinate, depending on where you're at, that's not going to be the case. Even with 200 feet, you're going to have some distortion related to that. These numbers are greatly reduced using these kind of systems. A couple things I think that does, first of all, this bill seems to make it a way easier on you in the future, because as we add more of these systems to densify in areas that we haven't already done, we won't have to come here asking for changes to ORS-93 again. It also does give it recognition, helps on the steps to getting NGS to recognize it, which does a couple of things for everybody, private, public. Once that starts happening, then all the vendors that supply all the CAD software, as you're talking about, or the design software, all the hardware and the software for the mobile, for all of the excavators, all the survey software, as they start seeing these things adopted by at a national level or even at a state level that we've actually gotten some kind of rigidity to it, they'll start applying these corrections, mathematical models into their system as it comes in versus someone having to go in and enter them themselves. And I guess that's really all I had, unless you have any other questions. But I mean, from a private standpoint, it's a win-win for us.
It's going to make it easier for people in your profession.
Yeah, and I think it'll make it easier.
Bottom line.
Yeah, and you had questions.
Is it going to cause anybody any trouble?
No.
Well, there you go.
You cut to the meeting.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? We do have to bring this back to get your amendment, and I suspect we need to get a financial on it, on amendment at least. Thank you much for your indulgence today, and are you done?
Yep.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 877. Is there any further business before the committee? There's none. Thank you very much. We adjourn.
Gentlemen.